so that we might see the issues that we talk about, let's look at the meaning of human existence. Would anyone have Psalm 1 open and would like to read that for us? Okay, would you do that, please?
The first verse only?
The whole Psalm.
The whole Psalm?
Right.
Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law doth he meditate day and night. And he shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water that bringeth forth its fruit in his season. His leaf also shall not wither, and whatsoever he doeth shall prosper. The ungodly are not so, but are like the chaff which the wind driveth away. Therefore the ungodly shall not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knoweth the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish.
Okay, now, is that Psalm speaking about a physical condition or spiritual condition? Okay, let me have you with me look at some physical and spiritual things that happen in our life. The reason we had the psalm read, so that we could see both sides of us. You know, Jesus became human. He was God and man. He was divine and human. And we have our physical and our spiritual part about us. So under the little first question we have, that's not a question, but the statement, all we can see is darkness ahead, I would like to talk to us a little bit about the meaning of human existence. And when I talk about the meaning of human existence, I would like to ask you, how do you perceive yourself? When I say perceive, I mean see. How do you feel about yourself? Do you feel that you are strong or weak? Do you feel that you are effective or ineffective? Do you feel that you are liked or disliked by others? That's what we mean when we say how one perceives himself. You know, they tell us that sickness, the meaning of sickness, is an arrested development. That everything rests. The development that starts. If a child is growing and he becomes sick, that normal development stops. And also sickness can be described as a fixation. Something that just will not get in place. And the other thing that can be seen about sickness is regression. No progress. No progress. It's not like when President Woodrow Wilson died, you know, the report came out, he's better, he's better, he's better, he's dead. But sickness is a regression. You're not getting better. You're getting worse. Okay, so as we look at that now, the meaning of human existence, that's what happened many times in the urban areas. The way a person think and feel about themselves determine how they will act out the role in their life. If you feel that you are sick, weak, ineffective, it's very little that you're going to get accomplished. If you, on the other hand, feel that you are strong, effective, and that you are liked by other people and you like other people, then the chances are that you're going to accomplish some things in your life. Now the psalm says that the man would be like a tree planted not by a little dripping of water, but by how, what kind of water? By rivers of living waters, that the tree would never thirst for the kinds of thing it needs. So that's the meaning of existence, where we have what we need to do the things that God has placed us in the world to do. The little aeon of that is, I felt like I was in a cage. I don't suppose any of us have ever been locked up in a cage. It feels so boxed in that there is no place to go, there is nothing to do. This is how many of the people who find themselves below the poverty level in life feels and see things. And when we talk about the children in the ghetto, when a young man or boy has to leave home and start working at the age of 14 or 15, he becomes a man and he has to work because there is no father in the house, and he's trying to help the little welfare that they receive. he start out in life at 14 or 15. You see how the caging in of a person's life, not really ever being able to fulfill that role or that place that God has put in their life with any kind of meaning. And that is why we chose this little verse, Philippians 1:6. And does someone have that little verse where they can put their hands on it right away and read that one? Okay, would you read that one for us?
I'm sure that he who started a good work in you will go on to finish it till the day of Christ Jesus.
Okay, so you see, now the good work that it has started, this is also concerning the spiritual life. And as we look at the spiritual life, the physical life, all play a part in that life. Because with God there is only one life. And that is the life that we live in the presence of God as we live. You recall how Jesus said now concerning people. He said, if any one of us sees his brother every day and say that he loves God whom he cannot see and hates his brother, then he makes himself and makes God a liar. That is why when we ever talk about our relationship with people, our relationship with God must also bring itself on that same level. It was in that kind of talk that Jesus said to those disciples, if you do not in the Lord's Prayer from your heart forgive your fellow man, neither will your heavenly Father forgive you. And that is what we ask God in the prayer. And forgive us as we forgive others. As a part of how we look at ourselves. How do we look at ourselves? Do we see ourselves as being liked are disliked by others? So we come to the second part. How do I characterize myself? A slum neighborhood, that's what you call it. And as any of you know, if you will visit some of the, many of the homes in the neighborhood, in the urban plight, in those areas where people live, you will find a bare house. Almost barer than this room that we have here, with the lack of furniture, the kinds of furniture that would make a home livable, that would make a person feel like he is a child of God, make a person feel like he is progressing in his life rather than digressing in his life. The next thing we look at is the urban destruction. You know, as that hymn goes about change and decay all around I see, O thou who changest not, abide with me. That is what you see in those areas. Change and decay. The buildings becoming dilapidated and still standing. The streets are run down. That kind of thing happens in those areas. And then as you look at the services that are rendered in the area, there are no place for taxes for improvement. So as a result of that, the services goes down. The police services are down, but not as effective as it could be. The fire department, it isn't as effective as it could be because of the equipment. You have the street and the sanitation department is not as effective as it could be. Because there are not as many people in that area who can voice a concern that would be heard at the places where the decisions are being made. The next thing we look at is transportation. The transportation in those areas is not where the transportation should be. And also the health care facility. Many times people have to leave the area in order to find the kind of health care facilities that would be decent for them. This was why last week I talked about the majority or the minority that will be living 10 years from now, and that will be the aged. I see the aged in the years coming. You know, earlier, way many years ago, the Jews lived in what we now call the ghetto. in the rundown, dilapidated condition. Changes are coming. And I see the facilities, the things that I see happening in the urban areas where the facilities are run down, that kind of thing. I see it happening, unless there is a change made somewhere, with our elderly people. If you go to some of the homes, you can see some of the same things that we talked about here, the bare house, the destruction, the poor services, no transportation, the lack of health care facilities. This is beginning to build itself. And I suppose the people weren't far from looking at that when they brought out the Elderly People Act in 1970s. So the next thing we want to look at is number three. And before we go to number three, I have some more questions I would like to ask you as you look at that. The slum neighborhood, that's what you call it. Now, would you characterize yourself as being well-to-do or poor? In harmony with yourself or in inner conflict with yourself? Are you anxious, hostile, or kind and loving? Are you hard to get along with or easy to get along with? That's what you look at when you look at people who are in those kinds of conditions. You don't see many people characterizing themselves as well-to-do, because usually well-to-do people are in different places. You recall how Jesus said it when the people went out, and he asked them, "What did you go out in the wilderness to see? A man dressed in fine clothing? Or did you go out there to see a reed shaken with the wind?" And he told them what kind of people wear fine clothes in his day, for those that live in the king houses. But then he told them what John was really all about and what he was in his life. He said, of all the people that had ever lived, John was the greatest. But then he said something greater than that. He said, any of you who are considered the least in the kingdom of God is greater than he. So then after John the Baptist being as great as he was, then those of us who could be considered the least in the kingdom of God would be greater than John. Now, how do you characterize yourself? Do you characterize yourself by the things that you have, as we say, well-to-do or poor? Do we characterize ourselves by the kind of harmony we have created for ourselves? There is no conflict in my life. Everything is going good for me. That kind of thing. Is that how we characterize ourselves? And we'll come back and we'll talk about that a little bit more. But let's look at the next one. The next one is, the main problem is money. And if someone have 1 Timothy 6 verse 10, we would like to read that one.
"For the love of money is the root of all evil, which while some covet it after they have earned from the faith, have turned themselves through and
through." Okay. Now, let's look at that one a little bit after we have looked at the living condition of the people that we are talking about, especially as we look at the black perspective. Now, last week, you recall that I said that the question that was always asked, or that the blacks would always ask in this country, was not what must I do to be saved, but what was the question? What must I do to be free? Now that was the question, and we said the freedom was in terms of economics last week, didn't we? So the main problem is money. Now, let's look at that. Number one, the living is on welfare. You're always dependent upon someone else. Domestic work, probably the lowest type of paid work in this country today, and see the exploitation. The jobs, if they are there, they're only there for a while and then they leave. And the business and the property. is so low that you can't get much out of it. So we say money is the problem there because of the lack of money. I suppose we could say the lack of money could also be the root of all evil, but since St. Paul in Timothy says, the love of money is the root of all evil. Now think about that for a minute. He did not say money was evil, did he? He said the love of money. That has something to do with the mind, doesn't it? That's why I asked this in the very beginning, how do we perceive ourselves? It's how we think about things that make it good or bad. It is in the mind. Jesus said, from the heart proceeds all kinds of evil thoughts. And the imagination of our hearts are evil even from our youth. So what about others? How do we think about them? How do we see other people? The perspectives are very important, in the perceptions especially. How do we see other people? And our perception help us to guide whatever behaviors that we have. They also shape our thinking and they shape our action. So when St. Paul says that the love of money is now the root of all evil, the love of it. Now you may recall that Jesus said to his disciples, a new commandment I give to you. And what was that new commandment? That you love one another. And Jesus says, by this all people will know that you are my disciples. If you do what? Have love one for the other. And that is now where Jesus wants us. Instead of having love for this, we have love for people. You recall last week we also said that this buys everything that we do. There is nothing that I can think of that we do in life that money doesn't buy or pay for. So money is very important. It is, I suppose, one of the most important things that we can get in this country or in this life. But now the mind, as we use our mind to get these kinds of things, then that is why he was able to say that the love of money is the root of all evil. You know, there was two things that Solomon asked God to deny him while he lived, not to deny him as he lived. Do you recall what those two things was? He said, Lord, I don't want you to make me poor so that I will steal. I don't want you to make me so rich that I will curse you. Those were the two things he asked God not to deny him. Now that's what we're talking about when we talk about the main problem is money. Because when you're poor and you're hungry and you need something, whether the commandment says thou shalt not steal, then survival take over. And we know, all of us know, the first law of nature is survival. And that's where stealing and all of those kinds of things come in. That's why we want to look up that main problem. Now that will be a problem, as we said last week, going into the 80s. The major problem for our senior citizens now living in the urban areas is that little word right there. They are on a fixed income. They have to pay the same amount of money for every little product that they get as a person making $50,000 a year or more. Now this is what we talk about when we talk about the main problem, so that we will not ever overlook that kind of problem or priority, because it pays for and it stands for life. If a person needs Medicare, medical facilities, and they can't afford it, and their life depends upon it, and they can't get it, what do you think would happen to that person? They would steal or die, wouldn't they? You know, when in the early beginning of the church's history, the church looked at those kinds of things and looked at them from the eye of experience. They looked at those kinds of things as something God wanted them to do. The church then built schools. They built hospitals. They built all kinds of things to help people in their way of living. Now, if someone would look up Acts 5 to show you how involved people got into that kind of thing, let's look at Acts 5, verses 29. And how we ought to look at what we're about in our life. Right. Would someone read that little entire verse there for us? That's the one I did.
Here, the apostles answered, "We must obey God rather than men."
Okay, now, what was God saying, or what is God saying to us when we look at the perspectives that we're looking tonight? When we talk about the problems of money, what is it that God is saying to us? Or is God saying anything at all to us when we look at these Bible verses? You know, every time we look in the scriptures, we're supposed to hear God saying something to us. And we're supposed to sense, as the disciples did when they walked back from Emmaus, that God had talked to us whenever we open our Bibles and see. You know, the last time we said that it is not reading the Bible that makes us God's people. It is in living and doing what the Bible asks us to do that we become the people of God. And so that's what we do whenever we look at the scriptures. And whatever we look at, any of the things that we look at in our life. Now, before we go any further, I would like to say, as we've come down to point three, that as we would look at this now from a psychological standpoint, we say that we have a physical and a spiritual part of our life. As we look at this from a psychological standpoint, we may say that a person is not adjusted. He's maladjusted in his life. He is not fully functioning as a person should. That a person, we may say, he is neurotic or psychotic. But now, as we look at those things inside of us, around us, we have to also look at some of the goals and the assumptions that we build from goals. We should ask ourselves, but what does well adjustment mean? And how could that adjustment be applied to that person or to that situation that we're talking about? The next thing we need to look at, what do we mean when we say that someone is functioning well within the society in which he's living? Or what do we mean when we say that a person is emotionally mature? I suppose if we would look psychologically at what we are about in our life, there's only two things that make us well adjusted in our life. If we have the ability to do these two things in our physical life, that's almost all that's required of us. We can be well adjusted if we're able to work and if we're able to love. Those are the two things that make us well adjusted in our life. If we're able to love other people, and people are able to love us. If we are able to work, then we can be well adjusted, we've said, in our physical life. Now, there are some, as we've looked, some theological conclusions that we must look at also. We say that from the first Psalm, talking about a man, a person, as we look at the person, we conclude that he is a sinner, or that he is not in faith or on faith, that he has separated himself from God and from his fellow man. Those are theological views. Now, the goals that we would have as we look at the sinner, we look at the person who is not in faith, and we look at the person who has separated himself from God, then we look at the goals in the theological realm to see now how that person who is not in faith, who is a sinner, how he can become in faith, what he can do to be now not free, but saved. And we also ask ourselves, as we look at the goal, the next step is then forgiveness. How does the person obtain forgiveness in his life? And then the third thing we look at, his growth in grace and by love that we have looked in his physical life. And then the last thing we look for is the hope and the gift of the Spirit, the evidence that God is alive in his life. As Jesus said to Nicodemus, unless you are born of the water and of the Spirit, you cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. So then from the psychological perspective, the way from what is wrong to the goal may be turned in, we could say, in conditioning the person, in educating the person, re-education of the person, or either by some means of therapy. That is how we would deal with a person in his physical life when something is wrong with him. The next thing we look at from a theological perspective, the way will be by faith. And by faith, then, we look at faith as the gift of God. Over here, we see the person in his life and in his work doing things pretty much on his own with other people. But now when we come to faith, that becomes the gift of God. No person can get that for himself. It must come from God. And then man is finally saved, or he's healed by God. Never like he is in the physical side. God is at work doing all and everything in the person. He does not save himself, and he is not healed or saved by his own good works. So nothing that we do, that's why we're trying to say that there is a physical and a spiritual part of us, because there is a part that we work ourselves and the spiritual part or the theological that we cannot do for ourselves. So then you ask ourselves, what are the roots of the differences that we have? The differences between the physical life that I live as a father and the spiritual life that God has given to me as a father or as a person. And then we ask, as we look at these perspectives, do they lie in a different way of looking at the world? Do they lie in a different way of looking at people or looking at the situation in which we find ourselves? As we look at that part now, we can find many disagreements among us if we would talk about the political, the economics, or the social policies that hinges on the underlying conflict about what a person is or what a person ought to be in his life or what he is meant to be. These views can be quite false if we only look at a person and say he's psychotic or he is neurotic. These can be quite false. And they can also be distorted, oversimplified, and they can also be half-truths about things. Now, I suppose as we look at the issues tonight, we want to ask ourselves a few questions about those issues. We look at the issues and we say that something is wrong. That's the first question. But what is wrong? That's an assumption that we make, that something is wrong. And whenever we say something is wrong, whether this be by an assumption or whatever way we come up with something is wrong, then the next thing we want to do is to try and find out what ought to be or what could be. And we call these normative judgments. And we use our own judgment and say, this is what ought to be or this is what could be in the life of this person. And that would be the nature of the human fulfillment that we talked about, the fulfillment of the human life itself. And then we go to the third point that we want to look at, moving from what is wrong with us to what we are meant to be, or to what our fulfillment as God's people ought to be in this life. And then we ask ourselves, what is the way Recall that in the Bible, Jesus told us what is the way. But now to get from that way, which is a physical and a spiritual way, we need to look at both sides of the coin. You recall that I don't have any coins on me, but it was the time when Jesus said to those disciples, whose image is on that coin? So we have to look at both sides now of the coin. As we looked at the first three little phrases we have there, we, I suppose, would ask ourselves, what is wrong in the urban area that would make someone say, all that we can see is darkness ahead? One of the things we said was the way a person perceives himself. If a person sees himself as being in a cage that he cannot get out of, there is not going to be much ahead for them, will there? And there are many people who are living in the urban areas who feel that they will have to live there for the rest of their life because of the way the conditions of life has caged them in from every way. The lack of education, the lack of training, all of the lacks in a person's life that would stop them or prevent them from ever becoming the kind of person that God has said the person ought to be. Now, as we look at Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, there we talk about the creation. You notice I don't think that there is anything ever said in the Bible about evolution. I don't think that we teach evolution in our schools or even in the church. But you know, the way that we have handled people and our relationship with people sometimes make us feel that evolution is closer to what we practice than creation would be. And the reason I say that is because if we would practice the creation account, we would see everyone in the image of God needing the same kind of treatment that we would like to receive in our life. We would see others as being a part of that vast creation account of God where he say, I am come that they might have life and might have it more abundantly. We would look at that abundant life as belonging to all of the people of God everywhere, not only those around us that agree with us or that work with us. Those are some of the things that we look at. The next thing that we look at as we begin to unfold some of our ideas, and we will get into the spiritual theological aspects of this more in the second part than we will the first. Let's look at number four now. You can't make it. And that, I think, is one of the words that should be stricken from the Christian vocabulary. Now, where did that word come from? That we can't do something. You know, when Jesus came, this is the only word he said. In relationship to God and people. Can anyone tell me when Jesus said something about you cannot? Concerning this little thing right here, you recall he said something about you cannot. Give you another word and that may help you. You cannot serve. Okay, now, that's the time when Jesus was used the word you cannot. But Jesus said that all things are possible for those who believe. Now, and if we are able to believe, that God has come to do some things in our life and in our time, then we don't use the word we cannot. We start to say in what we can do. Because as God's people, we can do all things, as St. Paul says, through Christ, who is doing what to us? Strengthening us. Okay?
Maybe we'll be getting into this later, but just going back to the first part where all we can see is darkness ahead. People who are in a slum community, in the ghetto, how much power does the gospel affect them? Does it help them get out of the ghettos eventually? By their hope, by their working? Or does it make their life more bearable?
I think the last part probably would be more that it's helped their life, helped them to bear to the crosses of life. I don't think the gospel does much for them physically, except to lift them out of the drudgery of knowing that where they are is not much worse than where others are, except when, in the case of Lazarus and the rich man, that they can't get any help. No, they tend to be less if we judge it by church attendance. People who usually move from one plateau to the other one, as far as the financial realms of life, usually, you know, they have so many other interests. They have so many other social things that they can attend that if, you know, just going to church, if that's one mark of, not saying that they aren't Christian, they could be more Christian, but they aren't as active in their religious activities and church life as they once have been.
All through their rise, trying to get them outward, or, you know, like after they reach a plateau where they think they've made it, they
okay.
Lose their...
Yes, see, in the process of trying to arrive, the idea of arriving at a certain point takes so much out of a person's ability to do the things that they was once doing at this point, maybe going to church. Some people, in order to make it now, they work a second job. And then on the weekends, it's the only time they have time to relax, spend time with the family. But that's the kind of excuses you start getting when people begin to try to reach a plateau. And when they begin to reach the plateau, at each level of it, there are some excuses. You know, the taxes are higher here. They just bought a new car there, and they bought a boat, and they have to go away for 3 or 4 weeks this summer, so they spin up everything. And so at each one of the junctures, there is some excuse made for their inactivities or lack of it. In all areas, you find that all people, that's why we have to keep saying that, all people, you know, as the creation account goes, all people are just alike in everything, in every way. Now, those people who have very little react to given stimuli the same way. Those who have much react to stimuli the same way. So it's that kind of thing we have to look at. People, as Luther would say, saint, and never see them as this without the other. They always, but even when they are Christian people. And sometimes the sinner part of them pulls down so heavily that the saint part is just taken off. And that's why Luther was able to say that we're never always in grace, we're in and out all of the time. Okay, are there any other questions that you would like to Did that kind of answer the question? Okay. Good. So let's look at the next little thing, the role now of a ghetto school. You can't make it. You know, I was talking to our recruiter for the academies, the Air Force Academy and the Army and the Navy School. And we have very few, if any, of the young men and now young women coming out of our schools that are able to pass these scholastic tests to get into the academies. Now, one of our little students, year before last, went to the Air Force Academy, but he went to Luther High North. But that's one of the other things that's happening in our schools. We sent away something like 1,000 kids a year, and maybe like out of the class of 1972 when I came, and now 70, maybe 200 of these went all the way through. You know, because of the background, the kinds of things that happen in the schools. They don't have the facilities, they don't have the kinds of things that a school should have. And when they get through grade school, it's almost impossible to help them catch up all the way from what they missed in the grade school through high school. And when they get into college, there is no one any longer. We used to, in the private colleges, have people who would be able to help students on a one-to-one basis. But now the colleges and the universities have grown, so until you walk in a class and the professor will hand out the material for you the first day and never say anything else about it anymore. There's no spoon feeding at our colleges and universities. And the only thing that counts is the midterm, the final paper, and the final grade. And see, you can't go to school and experiment. You have to go there and put all that you can into whatever you're doing that first year. That's why now we're encouraging many of the young people to go to junior colleges, get the kind of general education that is needed, and get their feet on the ground, and then they can go into universities and colleges. And it will stop that kind of thing where you have only about a 2% coming out of school over that long time, or 20% or less. Okay, we're about 8:20 now, so we will break. Yeah, that's true. I think that the quickest way that we adjust to one another, if we would, you know, just talk about black-white relations, would be when we're in war and we, you know, adjust for survival. That's the quickest and the easiest, I guess, way to adjust. Okay?
I'll make it short, but talking about war and survival, this little article that I handed you, this gentleman, black gentleman, my father was in the hospital room once.
Mm-hmm.
It was due to him, I think, that my father survived his major surgery.
Okay.
That's why he was put in that room, because this black gentleman was recovering, who had had an accident on the job.
Yeah.
And the doctor who I worked for said, try to make him eat.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
And then they became the best friends. And that was the first black person my father had ever been with at 81 years.
Great. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you can't make it. Who said you could? Now that's where we were. And we were talking there about the role of the ghetto school. And I suppose the role there is to try, as they have in the past, to do some things. But I suppose if we move on to the economic opportunities that exist in those areas, especially the urban areas, there is not much. And everything comes from the outside. They're almost like a colony. There is nothing much that is generated in the area itself. And the exclusionary union practices, that there is almost no unions, or people have to go to court in order to belong to unions. These are some of the other major things that happened. And the flight of jobs. You know, the companies closed down and they moved to other areas. That's one of the other things, the reason people say you can't make it there. And housing. Housing become non-existent for a lot of people. And you know, most of the time when people get to the point where they can do better, they leave the urban areas, and then the deterioration continues and continues because you have nothing there to build it. So then the next two we have is the isolated elite type of community. That's what people want when they leave the urban area. Whether you're living in the inner city, which would be the inner core of the city, the fringes, which would be the out, it's still part of the city, but it's out there. And then the little fringes, what we would call the suburban areas, would be, this would be the suburban union. And this would be the fringes. And then this would be the inner city. Now those are the only type of, three type of people we have living in America. Because the rural people only come in when they are going to sell their produce. And they really never get to be a part of these communities. But these are the kinds of people that we have in the country where we live. Now, the rural people live differently than the people in the inner city. The people on the fringes live a little different than the people in the inner city, and the suburban people live a little different. So that's the difference when we go up the ladder to look at people. Now, sometime when people migrate from the city, the beautiful large church that used to sit here near the inner city area, the members first move out here, and then they commute back in to the church. And then when the members move from here out to here, and enough of them get out, then they build another church. And then the people from the fringes start commuting here with these. And you see the flight. That's the flight of jobs. That same thing that happened with jobs. So most of it is there. And then you have very little here and very little here, except farm and what is going on then down in the inner city. Now, the reason the rural area is as less talked about as it is because there is fewer people living out here than there is any other place. And then these people here depend upon these people, and these people depend upon these people for their livelihood. And so the one then supply everything for all of the three that are living in. The majority of the people then would live there. But this is where we look at, when we look at the kinds of things when we say you can't make it. Now if you start saying that you can't make it as a church unless you're out here, or you can't make it as a person unless you live out here, or somewhere in between here, you see what's going to soon happen to everybody that can leave this area will be leaving, trying to get out to the promised land. And we will always have that as long as we have people. Because when people move from this area to this area, it is very beautiful. This is the way it was set up in the first beginning of the country. The little inner city, and you had all the people living in here. Then the people moved out a little bit in between here in these areas they call the suburban area. Then after they put the bypasses around the cities and thing, then people would move out in the county or in other areas they would call it, and then they would situate themselves out there. And that's what you have now. These people say we're living much better than the people here, therefore we can talk about them. People here say we can live in much better than these people, therefore we can talk about them. And then these people become the kind of people that you look down upon. See, everyone has to have something to look down at. So everyone who's living out in suburbia looks down at the people who are living on the fringes, and the people on the fringes then are able to look down at the people who are living in the inner city. And then there's no place to go from there to look down. Every place you look is up. And that's why these areas look so good from here. And that's why this area looks so bad from here. It's because of the kind of thing that we talked about in the beginning when we say, how do you look at yourself, or how do you perceive yourself? Are you well-to-do or poor? That's the look. When we look at our inner cities, we look at them from that vantage point. You know, we're looking for something. We drive through the area, you know, we say, I can remember 20 years ago, that was a beautiful area right here. 20 years ago. And so we're sitting here saying that. These people say, you know, I remember 30 years ago, that was one of the most beautiful parks. But then there's not been any kind of thing happening in that park since that time. And now they've gone out here and built some other little parks that are new, and they look good. So that's what happens when we look at the urban area, when we look at other people, that kind of thing. That's why our projection of ourselves onto other people take a different kind of image when we look at things from that vantage point. So when we say you can't make it, that's what we're talking about. You can't make it down there because we weren't able to. And we had more money, and we had more training, and we had more of all of it taken. We couldn't make it, therefore we know no one else can. So as a result, then the business will pull out. Then the churches. Then the schools. And the people start with it. The migration. So that's how we look at things when we look at what is happening within a city, a family, or anything that we have. So as we look at those kinds of things, I would ask us a few questions at this point. What do you plan to do as a result of this class concerning the Black perspective? When I ask that question, I'm talking about what do you plan to do in your personal life? And secondly, what do you plan to do in your personal life to influence other people to see things a little different than they have seen them in the past? Is there anything we can do? So let's go then to number 5 and look at that isolated elite community. Racial isolation and social responsibility, the attitudes. Now, when we talk about that special elite group, let's look at what we are saying and how we're saying things when we look at that special little elite group. The inner city has gotten smaller. It's the core of business. Very few people are living there, and the kind of people are living there, they're in apartments, more or less. There's no homes, usually, that much in the inner city, so it has become smaller. Very few businesses and that kind of thing. So then the people on the fringes, this has become a little larger, but it still surrounds the city limits. These are all other kinds of little municipalities around that area. So in order to form an elite community, these groups, people go out here someplace and develop a little community, about 50 houses, and they will say anyone buying a house in this area cannot build it for less than $80,000. Okay? That's the minimum that you can build a house for in that community. That becomes an elite kind of community. And this is what we have when we start going out into these areas. You see what you've done already. You've eliminated a whole lot of these folks. All of these. And maybe the majority of these, just a few of these out here. But that's how those elite communities are formed. And many of our so-called suburban areas are like that. When there are new houses being built, they will stipulate that the house, no house can be built that would cost less than $80,000, $100,000, $150,000, whatever it is, in order to have only the elite group of people living in that area. Now that's what we mean when we start talking about the isolated, the elite group. And then as a result of that, you can form a racial group that will have the same kind of social responsibility for the kinds of things that they want. But then when this little community is formed, there is a little board that will be formed to decide who can move into that little community. And they have it open so that just enough and no overcrowdingness can take place in that kind of community. And then after that little elite group could get things going good, well, some of them may decide that over here another elite group should form. You see how far we're getting away from the main stream of everything that used to be, you know. The taxes are lower out here. So you can commute to work and that kind of thing, but your taxes are lower. It's quieter, that kind of thing. So that's what we look at when we look at the elite. Those that are out, and then the homes are larger, and the lots that they build the homes on are larger. Then we look at the attitude. No, the social responsibility first. The social responsibility say to the folks that we need a country club. And so as a result of that, we build a country club, and we'll charge our members $100 a year, $150 a year to belong to the club. So if you get 100 people belonging to that club at $100 a piece, that's $100,000 that they would have coming in all of the time to run the little country club and the things that they spend during the year. So that's how that elite and that social responsibility now is to this little community. Nothing at all to do with any of that's out there. We've left that behind. So that's what we talk about when we talk about that, the culture thing you was talking about. It's formed by the people who develop and live there. And then the culture only changed when other people would move into this culture and would bring some things with them that would be different than was there before. So that's the kind of thing that happened when we are looking at those communities. So finally, the last thing we have down there is a little quote. Look, baby, no one is going to help you but yourself. Then the will to act. And that will, the will to act then, is to get many of the folks from here. Now, the way things happen in the urban area, is that the real estate people in this kind will then sell homes to these people who live here for a substantial amount more than the home is worth. But then that way, this person who's living here would be able to sell their home and then move to this area. See how the progression worked. And then this person, property is really worth nothing down here almost. You just give it away or get rid of it however you can. So that's how the game is played of life. Each little group is pushing one up to that level, and when that one is pushed up to that level of the friends, then these people are pushed up to this level. And when this person is pushed from this level to this level, then that person may be able to get into that community. But you see, it's about 20 years then, and this community that you, that was the elite community, now becomes the fringe and it moves and become an elite community out here someplace. So it never catches up with that elite group that started in the first place. And so that's how the game of life is played as we look at it. Okay, I would like to try to sum up tonight some of the things that we went through so that next Thursday night we can look at and sum up all of the things that we tried to pull together in the black perspective. Now, I think last night and tonight we've looked at some of the situations and the issues that faces us in this country. The source for understanding the black perspective, I feel, should be as follows. The last week and a little, most of the last week, we talked about the biological and the anthropological look or evidence as determined by the different perspective looking at slavery, the biological things that happen to people, and the non-human part of the slaves as the anthropology that we looked at. And we touched a little bit on it tonight about the neurotic phenomena as one aspect of a person. A person develops physically and spiritually. We looked at the psychological side of a person. And I think we've looked at the economics and the political processes in their historical development. And we've also looked at the broader aspect of human life rather than in the nature of his development as an individual, as we look tonight a little bit. And we also would hope that we had looked at the inner experiences of a person. It's what a person thinks in his mind that makes him what he is. And number five, we looked at an individual become a person only in relation to other people and relation to other things. The interpersonal in a larger context rather than in the society and the culture. A person become an individual because he is in relationship or in relation to something other than just the context of his relationship in the culture and the society in which he lives. We try to also imply that rooted in the prophetic and the Christological perspective of the Old and New Testament, we see illuminated in this the human experience better than we do in anything else that we look at. And number seven, we looked at the blending of material from the social, psychological point of view and also from a theological stance to see the whole of human existence. And finally, we wanted to look at the Christological perspective supported by and constructed with the awareness of the contribution of the psychological disciplines and an understanding of the proper perspective for blacks in this country. So those are the kinds of things we hoped that we would be able to cover with you during these two nights so that we could next week come up with a program that would do something now for the church. We try to cover in these two nights the kinds of things that as citizens, we said last week, whatever makes a good Christian makes a good citizen. We try to talk about those things that make us good citizens. The kinds of things that are bad within our country so that as people of God, we can respond to the kinds of things that we need to respond to in our life. Okay, so we have a few moments now that we can look at some of those aspects and issues now that we have as a country. You know, we said our country was set up on the basis of freedom to be, act, and to live as people. This was, we say our forefathers came for religious freedom as well as other freedoms. But our freedom as we see it, or as it has been seen particularly from the black angle, was the freedom to do only two things. Jobs and financial stability. Now, one of the things I'd like to see in offering a course or class in the black perspective was to get us as Christians to see our role as the people of God in the affairs and in the lives of people in the country. You know, we in this country, we have rights and obligations. One of our rights we will demonstrate on November the 2nd. That was a right that we have not always been able to use. So that kind of thing, as we look at the freedom now, the role of what happens when these things are available. Many people say they will not use their freedom on November the 2nd. They don't feel it would do any good. And even if it did, they don't feel that using it would change anything. That was one of the reasons I asked us tonight, how did we perceive ourselves? You know, have we got to that point in our life where we don't feel there is much that can be done to really help ourselves or even help others? Some have gotten to that point in their life, that things are useless. And when a person starts seeing things or not seeing things in the proper perspective, then that's how they feel about a lot of things. We also want to look at ourselves as the people we are first, and then redeemed as we are. We ought to be able to do some things about our life. And as we looked at these little Bible verses tonight, I don't think we looked at this one, did we? 1 John 3:2. Someone have that one that we could read finally, and then we. Okay.
Beloved, now are we the sons of God, and if thou shalt not hear, we shall be. But we know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him, and we shall see him as he is.
Okay. Now that's, I think, is our role in life, is to be like Christ was when he was here upon earth. You know, he had to look at all aspects of people's lives. When Christ went to those people that were great sinners, he forgave them. When he went to the adulterers, he forgave them. When he would talk to those who felt there was no way to be forgiven, he forgave them. When he came to the process, not just only of voting, but also of taxes, which was unfair as they were at the time, Christ was able to give to the people the kind of answers that they need. Now, that's what I think our role as the people of God is, to be just as Christ was when he was living upon the earth. He said that we would be able to do greater things in our life than he was ever able to do in his life. So as we began now, you know, when Jesus came, the Father sent him. And now when the Holy Spirit came, Jesus sent him. But now when you and I come to do things, who sent us? The Spirit? The Holy Spirit?
Jesus?
And the Father, who creates us, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit sends us. See, the Father sent Jesus. As the Father sent me, I'm sending you. So Jesus sent the Spirit to be with us. So now we have, or should have, more of the ability to accomplish God's purpose now that Jesus has come and done everything that needed to be done for us over against all of the other things that we could ever do in our life. That was one of the reasons we said tonight that even though John was as great as he was, we are considered to be greater than even John the Baptist, who was able to baptize Jesus. So that's why we brought those little Bible passages along tonight, so that we could begin to look at a program that the church itself could use to stand and play its role in the process of history, where many people all over the time would be able to see, demonstrated by the life that we have lived, the things that God is at work among his people. And where we would not be as the people out on the in the suburban area, able to look down upon the people in the fringes of the cities or the little municipalities, or to look down even further to those who are in the inner city. But our vision would be as the little steeples on our churches lead from earth to heaven. And that's the kind of thing that we will be discussing next week, to put into proper perspective, what do we do when we find out that there are some things that we as people need to be concerned about? What do we do? Do we just pray and say it will go away? You know, Jesus prayed many times to his Father, and he said to those disciples finally, I must go to Jerusalem, and there I must be crucified. And then when people heard Jesus talking that way, they said the words that he was saying was too hard for them. So they went and they left him. And Jesus was able to say to those disciples, now after all of the other ones have gone away, will you also go away? And they said, to whom should we go? You have the words of eternal life. Now, as we look at ourselves as then possessing eternal life, able to forgive sin, and still sometime we don't, how do you think we make God feel? You know, that was a serious thing for Jesus when he was here upon earth. The forgiving of others of their sin was the thing that he saw most as being the most important thing in his life. Whenever he would forgive someone for a grievous sin, he would say, I forgive you. Go and sin no more. Even when the people caught the woman that was caught in adultery and brought her before Jesus and said, now in the law of Moses, she should be stoned to death. So Jesus said, same thing we're asking ourselves. How do you perceive yourselves? As holy, without sin. So then Jesus said, let the first one among you that is without sin cast the first stone. And he turned and he began to write on the ground. And when he stood up, all had gone. And that's how Jesus wants us to look at suburbia, the fringes, and a city. Those of us who are without sin, we should cast the first stone. Must give you kept on until I had the kid. So I think that's our role then as people, to see the proper perspective that God has placed us in the world to see, and to be the kind of people that God wants us to be. So that with our life that God has given us to live, however long he permits us to live, that we will be able to do those two things that Luther called good work. Everything that we do, think, speak, or say out of love for one another and to the glory of God then become a good work in our life. So that role that we project, that role that we carry, then becomes what in our life God has always intended for it to be. Now he says, blessed is the man that walks not in the counsel of the ungodly. So where are the ungodly? Or sit in the seat of the scornful. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in that law will he meditate. And what does it mean to meditate? To say, to think, to be in the presence of God at all times. And then as he meditates, that's both day and night. So we don't have to ask the question, what happened to my faith when I sleep? And his law does he meditate both day and night. So what happened to my faith when I'm asleep? Does it go away? God, who is able to put life into a body, is also able to sustain faith while we sleep. He will meditate both day and night so that then we are kept within the power and the domains of God as we see ourselves in that kind of thing. And then it talks about he being like a tree planted by the rivers of water. Now notice what that tree does. Bears fruit. Its leaf also shall not wither, but it bears fruit. That's what that tree is doing. Where the leaf will not wither. And you know, as we put that word up on the board before, can anyone define for me what love is? It's a difficult word to. Agape, yeah. Eros. Right. But is there a false love? You know, we got eros and phileo, also for the Greek word of love. But love is something that is always producing. Love has to produce something. Now just think in your mind for a few moments when we all during that young, nuptial years of our life, when we fell in love, that love produced something, union between two people. And from that, in many instances, that love produced another living person. So love is always producing. You get something, so love is nothing that sits out here by itself. It always produces. And that was why John was able to say of Jesus that God so loved the world that he produced his only son for that world that we have. And so that's when Jesus said, a new commandment I give unto you is that you produce. In many instances he said, occupy until I come. But that's what the meaning of love is, that we produce. And love grows and it produces and it makes things. You know, love make a person unselfish. As we look at the thing what love does in 1 Corinthians 13, it's just that's where the word agape is also used there. Love is kind. It is patient. All of the good things that you can think of, you can place them on the love. But then as we look at it now, as we said in the last little part there, the will to act, and that's where we want to find ourselves in meaning and also how we characterize ourselves and how we look at others. In that will to act, because it is not our will to act in the way that we act, but it is God's will that we, as his people, then move in this role as his people, and then began to build up one another in love and in fellowship. Okay, so next week we will now then look at the programs in which the church itself, our church, can look at some of these roles, some of the images, the situations that we have looked at, and also the issues, and then develop some meanings for our own selves. So we have a few moments then for questions, okay?
This doesn't apply, we had it on the board last week, but my husband and I were discussing a little bit, and we didn't exactly